Hello and welcome to NewsHour on the BBC World Service. My name is Celia Hatton and I'm speaking to you live from our studio in central London. Today, a day of big reactions inside Ukraine. Kyiv's response to how the whole conflict is viewed by Donald Trump and the way in which he's described how it all began. The US president could not make it clearer. In the fight between the invader, the Russians, and the defenders, the Ukrainians, he's not even neutral. He believes the Ukrainians started the war. Here he is speaking to reporters last night.
I want to see peace. Look, you know why I want? Because I don't want all these people killed anymore. I'm looking at people that are being killed, and they're Russian and Ukrainian people, but they're people. Doesn't matter where they're from on the whole planet. And I think I have the power to end this war. And I think it's going very well. But today I heard, oh, well, we weren't invited. Well, you've been there for 3 years. You should have ended it 3 years. You should have never started it. You could have made a deal. I could have made a deal for Ukraine that would have given them almost all of the land, everything, almost all of the land, and no people would have been killed and no city would have been demolished and not one dome would have been knocked down.
President Zelensky responded, saying the U.S. was being misinformed.
We are seeing a lot of disinformation, and it's coming from Russia. We understand this, and we have proof that these figures are being discussed between America and Russia. Unfortunately, President Trump, with all due respect for him as the leader of a nation that we respect greatly, the American people, is living in this disinformation space.
Also, in the last few hours, the American Special Envoy for Ukraine, Keith Kellogg, arrived in Kyiv for talks with President Zelensky and other top officials, saying Washington was willing to listen.
We understand the need for security guarantees. Part of my mission is to sit and list and say, hey, what are you concerned? Well, yes, we can go back to the United States, talk to President Trump and with the Secretary Rubio and the rest of the team, just ensure that we get this one right.
We'll look at those U.S.-Ukraine talks in a moment. But first, let's hear the view on the ground from the Ukrainian city of Odessa. Michael Bosorkiu is the former spokesman for the OSCE. That's the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, the special monitoring mission in Ukraine. He's a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, and he lives in Odessa.
Well, it's very dire right now. We had what is basically a tsunami of Russian drones come overnight. It was very loud, and of course it was very loud in Kyiv as well. They were badly struck. But what's happened here, we had a low of -7 overnight, is hundreds of homes were cut off from power, from heating with light and water. And that's because the Russians typically target critical infrastructure. Schools were hit, so students are studying distance learning today, and also medical facilities. So no obvious military targets, but this is something that happens almost nightly, and I should add just a few hours after those talks wound up in Saudi Arabia, which was quite surprising.
So it's business as usual, really, when it comes to Russian attacks. There's been no change since the U.S. engaged Russia in talks?
Yeah, business as usual. You would have thought that at least the Americans would have told the Russians as a kind of confidence building measure, why don't you hold off on the daily barrage of rockets and missiles, give peace a chance. That didn't happen. And as far as I know, they didn't even tell them to cut ties or stop receiving drones and weaponry from and soldiers from places like Pyongyang and Tehran. So it's a very confusing set of negotiations. I know they were described as initial talks, but one, again, with the United States supposedly being an ally of Ukraine as well, one would have thought that would have been the first demand they would have made.
How are the people around you, the people in Odessa, reacting to what they've been hearing on the world stage in the past few days, the words of Donald Trump, the words coming from Sergei Lavrov, for instance, who's just said on Monday in Riyadh that the Russians have never endangered the Ukraine civilian energy supply systems?
Yeah, pretty incredible statements. Well, let me start by saying the expectations were very low here anyways. People did not expect much to come out of these talks. But now that they've happened, and now, especially after Mr. Trump has basically pulled the rug from out under Mr. Zelensky, calling him illegitimate, things like that, there's, I don't think in my 3 years here I've ever detected a darker mood. I think there's a lot of discussions going on whether to stay or whether to go, because there is a big, big fear here right now that Trump, in his very erratic style, could all of a sudden stop sharing intelligence information with Ukrainians, but more crucially for civilians here, is dismantling that Patriot missile defense system that protects Ukrainian cities day in and day out. I mean, that could be game over for Ukraine if that were to happen.
So you're saying that people around you are considering just leaving Ukraine entirely?
Look, it's here in Odessa, which is really a symbol of irrepressible resilience. It's not necessarily the numbers. A lot of people have left, but it's who's leaving now, kind of the movers and shakers, owners of businesses, influential people who, if they haven't moved already, they are preparing to do so. They're also thinking of selling their properties, moving their parents. Now, that's a really, really big deal. These are kind of things happening under the surface, but they are happening not only here, but in many other places in Ukraine because of the fear that I was describing.
Michael, as the misery mounts, as people confront really difficult decisions on whether to stay or whether to go, is there any support for the idea that the conflict simply needs to end, whether it is worth accepting the price demanded by the Russians or demanded by the Americans? Mm-hmm.
Well, a couple of things there. Number one is so much blood has been spilt. So many sons and daughters of Ukraine have been killed fighting for its freedom, for its existence, that there's no going back in the minds of many Ukrainians. The other thing is that there's no way Ukrainians will agree to live under Russian occupation. And I say that because part of Russia's demands is also grabbing what's left of Zaporizhia and Kherson Oblast and holding on to Donetsk and Luhansk. That's a huge piece of territory. These are pieces of land where Ukrainians still have their parents, homesteads, things like that. They're still living under Ukrainian control. But should that disappear, Europe, I can tell you, will feel it very immediately with another massive flow of people looking for a taste of freedom and for security.
That was Michael Balser-Q, non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, speaking to us earlier from Odessa. Well, listening to that interview is Oleksandr Mrejko, an MP with Mr. Volodymyr Zelensky's ruling servant of the People Party and chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee at the Ukrainian Parliament. He joins us live now. Mr. Mrejko, you've just heard the grim feeling expressed from Odessa there, but you've also heard the comments before that from Donald Trump expressing his view that the Ukrainians could have ended this conflict before it even began. What's your response?
Well, of course, we strongly disagree with such vision by Mr. Trump, but it means that to clear the air, we need to have direct contact between our president, Mr. Zelensky, and Mr. Trump. And I'm sure that having such systematic, constant and stable communication between both presidents, all the issues can be solved very easily, and all such kind of stereotypes can be removed.
You seem to have faith, though, that a lot could be solved if Mr. Zelensky could get more time with Mr. Trump. But the two men have met before. What do you think could be different in the future?
The difference might be that we need to have a constant and systematic contact, almost on a daily basis. And a good sign that his representative, his envoy of Mr. Trump, Mr. Kellogg, Keith Kellogg, he has just arrived to Kiev, and he's eager to listen to our arguments and to convey them to Mr. Trump.
We've also heard Donald Trump pointing out that Ukraine has not had an election in some time. He said that just overnight. Does it sound to you like Mr. Trump is trying to force your president out of office, like he's really eager to meet with Mr. Zelensky repeatedly?
I don't think so, but I have suspicion that someone in the entourage of Mr. Trump might be pushing this pro-Kremlin narrative about elections during the war, because the only person who is interested in having such elections in Ukraine during the war is Putin, because he wants to undermine us not only from outside, but also from within. And he understands perfectly well that an instrument to undermining morale in Ukraine and creating sort of division within our society is to have elections before the martial law is lifted.
You've mentioned this sort of pro-Russia narrative that's being fed to the Americans. Do you think that Ukraine needs to be more forceful in calling out the things that Donald Trump says? Or does that risk an overt rupture between Washington and Kyiv?
Even among the closest friends can be some misunderstanding. But I believe that we should remain respectful with regard to Mr. Trump. We should be constructive and we should remain optimistic. And I'm sure that we can find persuasive enough arguments for Mr. Trump to convince him. But again, we need for that constant communication between the presidents at the highest level.
Where does this optimism come from with you? You seem to have confidence that Mr. Trump and his team have the Ukrainians' best interest in mind, despite what we've been hearing from the mouth of Donald Trump in the past 24 hours.
Well, we have no right to be pessimistic because it's self-fulfilling prophecy. And I would like to recall words of Churchill, who said, "I'm an optimist and I don't see reason to be anybody else." So we have no choice but to remain optimistic, proactive, and insist on our interests, because it's about survival of our country. And for us, Mr. Trump is reality, and our fate depends also on his policy.
You're calling for near constant communication between Mr. Zelensky and Mr. Trump. Is there any evidence that that could happen?
I'm sure it will happen. And a good sign of the beginning of such constant dialogue is the visit by Mr. Kellogg. I hope that it's only the start of more constant dialogue and more meetings.
Mr. Marashko, just briefly, are there any signs that a third party might be able to come forward, for example, China, to help you to negotiate a reasonable end to this conflict?
Well, I recall what Mr. Trump once said on Twitter, this mysterious, little bit enigmatic phrase that China can help. Theoretically, China can help because Putin is afraid of China and China could stop Putin's aggression. But the truth is that China is not interested in this. For China, Russia is junior partner, and China would never do anything which goes against interests of Russia. China is not interested in Russian defeat.
Okay, Mr. Marashko, thank you. That was Oleksandr Marashko, an MP with Mr. Volodymyr Zelensky's ruling servant of the People Party and chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee. Coming up, fans of the TV show White Lotus are upset the theme for its third season has changed. But are they right to complain?
Obviously, it's changing with the mise-en-scene of each of the series. The theme is sort of there, but it's gone much, much darker. And I think people have been put off by the fact that suddenly it's beginning to sound like a dance piece. This is starting to sound a little bit generic.
Coming up in a few minutes' time. The other stories we're covering in the newsroom this hour. Five Israeli reservists have been charged with severely injuring a Palestinian prisoner half a year after their arrest caused angry protests led by far-right ministers. And the Netherlands is to return more than 100 Benin bronze sculptures to Nigeria, where they were looted by British forces in the 19th century. You're listening to NewsHour. Now it's being called the biggest discovery for Egyptologists in 100 years. The first royal tomb to be uncovered since King Tutankhamun's tomb in 1922. This time, a joint British-Egyptian team of archaeologists has found the long-lost tomb of King Thutmose II, the last undiscovered royal tomb of the 18th dynasty. And the best is yet to come. Dr. Piers Litherland heads the British-Egyptian team based in Luxor. I asked him, they didn't think they were excavating the tomb of a king, did they?
We were working in an area called the Western Wadis, which is about 2.5 kilometers west of the Valley of the Kings at the opposite end of the mountain. And it's an area that's associated with royal women. So when we found this tomb, we expected it would be the tomb of a royal woman. And it was unexpectedly large. It had a large staircase and a very large descending corridor. But it took us a very long time to get through all that because, A, it was blocked with flood debris, and B, the ceilings had all collapsed. And it was only after crawling through a 10-meter passageway that had a small sort of 40-centimeter gap at the top that we got into the burial chamber and realized that the burial chamber had the remains of decoration on it. No woman's tomb of the 18th dynasty is decorated. And not only that, a part of the ceiling was still intact, a blue-painted ceiling with yellow stars on it. And blue-painted ceilings with yellow stars are only found in kings' tombs. But, I mean, the emotion of getting into these things is just one of extraordinary sort of bewilderment, because when you come across something that you're not expecting to find, it's emotionally extremely sort of turbulent, really. I can't really describe it in any other terms. I mean, when I came out, my wife was waiting outside, and the only thing I could do was burst into tears. We then started to clear all the flood debris, expecting to find underneath it the crushed remains of a burial. And in fact, the tomb turned out to be completely empty, not because it had been robbed, but because it had been deliberately emptied. We then worked out that the tomb had been flooded. It had been built underneath a waterfall, and it had filled with water at some stage within about 6 years of the burial. We now know that the burial was taken out through a subsidiary corridor and moved somewhere else. And it was only gradually, as we sifted through all the material, tons and tons and tons of broken limestone, that we discovered these small fragments of alabaster, which named Thutmose II. And these are fragments of alabaster vessels which were probably broken when the tomb was being moved. And thank goodness they did actually break one or two things, because that's how we found out whose tomb it was.
Do you know where the contents of the tomb have been moved to?
We've got a pretty good idea, yes. But they've been very cleverly disguised. They've been put under about 25 meters of rock and limestone plaster. They're quite difficult to get at, but we think we know where they are. And, I mean, the real significance of this find is the second tomb, the place to which these things were probably moved. Because if, as we believe, they were moved into the second tomb, that tomb is likely to be intact because there are no extant grave goods of Thutmose II in any museums or public collections. The only objects that have been found relating to the burial of Thutmose II have been found by us in this wadi.
How big a deal would it be if you got access to that second tomb?
One has to bear in mind that Thutmose II is considerably earlier than Tutankhamun, but this would be only the second king's tomb to be found with all its major grave goods in place. They won't be as wonderful as Tutankhamun's, I don't think, but all the same, the contribution to the knowledge of what kings were buried with would be absolutely enormous.
Dr. Piers Litherland. Fighting in the DRC and the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, M23 rebel fighters, backed by Rwanda, are continuing their advance amid a growing humanitarian crisis. The rebels, who are largely ethnic Tutsis, took control of the city of Bukavu on Sunday. This follows their lightning capture of Goma, the largest city in the mineral-rich region. Our senior international correspondent, Orla Guerin, now reports from Goma.
I'm standing in a recovery room in Ndosho Hospital in Goma. There are three patients here on trolleys, all young men. And here in this hospital alone, there are four operating rooms in use all day, sometimes at night, to try to keep up with the volume of war-wounded civilians and soldiers who have been brought in.
My name is Miriam Favier. I'm based in Goma for the International Red Cross.
We are here now at the Ndosho Hospital. You have more than 300 patients. You have beds for 146. How much pressure have the doctors and the nurses been under?
I think it's been a terrible situation for the doctors. They slept in the OTs. Our medical supplies were looted at the very beginning of the escalation of the conflict in Goma.
Tell me about the kind of injuries you've been receiving.
It was a lot of gunshots. It was also an increasing number of explosive devices. Also pediatric war surgery, because a lot of children were also wounded.
We meet some of them in a tent in the hospital grounds. David, who's 15, cries in pain. He was hit in the face by a stray bullet. In the next bed, 13-year-old Hashima winces as he tries to shift his weight. One of his legs is now a bandaged stump. His relative, Tantin, tells us what happened.
A bomb fell on the child, killing his parents. It was a Sunday. It was the M23 who dropped the bomb. There was fighting between them and the army. They dropped the bomb, and I lost 6 members of my family.
While Tantin mourns, some welcome the M23 to Bukavu. It's the second major city they have captured recently. They prefer liberated. M23 say they are defending ethnic minority Tutsis. Human rights groups accuse the rebels and their enemies, the Congolese army, of killing and raping civilians. I'm at the edge of Goma. There are green hills all around in the distance, and stretching out as far as the eye can see, there are rows and rows of white tents, some very scrappy, falling apart. I'm in a camp called Bulengo, one of several camps here for people who have been displaced by fighting. Crowds gather around us to say they are being displaced again by an ultimatum from M23. Among them, a young mother called Divine, who has a babe in arms.
We were here when they came and told us, you have 3 days to leave. We were scared because we have nowhere to go. The houses have been destroyed. There are none left. Hunger is killing us in the camp. But we don't see how we can go home to nothing.
M23 say they are encouraging voluntary returns. But that's not how it feels to many here. We saw an extended family setting off with what little they had tied to their backs. Cooking pots, rolled up bedding and a wooden stool.
The family are on their way now. They've told us it will be a 2-day journey. Many say they're frightened to leave, but they're also scared to stay.
Orla Guerin reporting from Goma in the DRC. You can read more analysis from Orla and photographs our team has taken there from the ground on the BBC News website. Welcome back to NewsHour. It's a question that's often asked. What has more impact on whether you live a long and good life? Is it your genes that you're born with, the ones that you have no control over, or is it lifestyle and environmental factors that you can possibly influence? A new study from researchers at the Oxford Population Health Centre, published in the journal Nature Medicine, has used data from nearly 500,000 people to try and answer this question. I've been finding out more from Cornelia von Daun, one of the authors of the study.
So what we basically found is that the most important determinant in the UK population of the lifespan that you are about to have is your lifestyle as well as your living conditions. The most important determinant is smoking still, although we know for half a century that is not a good idea for your health. But the second one was your social, economical and financial situation, which is very much determining how old you will become. And the third one is, of course, not the most popular one, is whether you are physical active or not.
So two sides to this coin, really, because many people would think, OK, well, I can choose whether to smoke or not. I can choose, in theory, whether to be physically active or not. But many people obviously can't choose their living conditions. They can't choose to suddenly jump out of poverty. So does that mean that some people are just condemned to live a shorter life?
Well, that's something we have to address as a society, of course. And I think we all realize that the chances that people have to get a healthy lifestyle is very much also determined what the chances were that your education was successful and that your career path was successful.
Professor, to be clear, you found that few diseases really are entirely or very strongly genetic.
For the individual, it's important to realize that for some diseases, and for the most important disease that I study, dementia, we see that it's not so much the lifestyle that determines whether you get the disease, but still, you can manipulate the disease onset in the sense that some people will develop the disease at 65, while others develop it at 85. And that is quite a difference of 20 years.
So you're saying that genetically you might be predisposed to dementia, but it's your environmental factors that dictate whether you will experience the effects of dementia at 65 or possibly at 85.
It's your environmental factors. And in the case of dementia, then one of the driving factors is also your education, but it's also your possibilities to get to medication. So these kind of problems have to be tackled. It's not only dementia that has a genetic origin. We also see that prostate cancer, breast cancer, very important cancers that we all are confronted with in our families are really also genetically determined, but also have these possibilities of early prevention.
Cornelia Fondown, Professor of Epidemiology at Oxford Population Health.
I'm Celia Hatton, and this is NewsHour coming to you on the BBC World Service. Every week now, since the ceasefire began, produces a moment of truth in Israel and Gaza. When Hamas first began releasing hostages, we saw mostly healthy young women being handed over to Israel, and then increasingly emaciated older men who'd been held captive. Alongside that, we've seen hundreds of Palestinians also being released, with many telling their own tales of torture at the hands of the Israeli authorities. And now, the news from Hamas that this Saturday, it will release more hostages than expected, six living captives. And tomorrow, they'll hand over the bodies of four who have been killed. Among the dead, a mother and her two young children, the Bibas family, whose suffering came to symbolize the hostage crisis for many Israelis. Hamas also says it's ready to release all the hostages due to be freed in the next phase of the ceasefire deal with Israel in one go, rather than in batches, as it's been happening so far. The BBC's Sebastian Usher is in Jerusalem. He told me more about Hamas's offer.
I think it's really, you know, a kind of opening gambit to do with the second phase of a ceasefire that's due to start potentially in just over a week. So what Hamas is saying is, I think, to try and give a sense that it is ready to make concessions in a way. There's been more and more talk inside Israel coming from the families of hostages, and also we've had it from outside, particularly from President Trump, saying, why is this hostage handover process taking so long? Why is it week after week? Why isn't it all done in one go? So Hamas has said in the second phase, we can release all the hostages. Now, it wasn't entirely clear if that means all the hostages alive and dead or just all the living hostages in one go. That's as long as Israel lives up to the conditions of the ceasefire in ensuring that there is a complete troop withdrawal and that there's a permanent ceasefire, which, you know, are parts of what phase two is meant to accomplish. But there's been, I think, more and more doubt over whether that's really where it's going to head, particularly with this absence of there being serious negotiations underway. I mean, the Israeli Foreign Minister Gideon Saar did say a day ago that the talks would now begin. He didn't give a precise date, but he said this week. So we shall see what happens with that. As far as reaction, there hasn't really been government reaction to what Hamas said, but it's implicit in what government ministers from the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu down have said really all along, that any future of Gaza must be completely without Hamas. in this Hamas statement, there was the group's own response to that, saying that essentially it regards that as ridiculous and unacceptable. So I think it just shows really how difficult these negotiations for phase two are going to be.
Sebastian Usher. Well, let's go live now to Jerusalem and speak to Sharon Haskell, Israel's deputy foreign minister. You've heard, we've just discussed Hamas's offer there. What's your response?
Well, first of all, I think, you know, it was very interesting to see, to hear whether Israel will uphold the ceasefire or anything like that. I mean, look, Hamas has been violating the ceasefire agreement since day one. This has been very difficult, and we knew it's going to be difficult because they are a terrorist organization. We cannot rely on them. And they've done that to the point where they're actually threatened not to release any of our hostages in breaking completely the ceasefire.
But now they're so offering really to release all of the hostages in one go. Yeah, what do you say to them?
And so, you know, we, first of all, our goal is to release all of our hostages. But our another goal is to make sure that the 7th of October massacre will never happen again. And when you hear Hamas leadership saying over and over again in interviews that they will have the chance and they will commit a 7th of October again and again and again, you understand that, you know, you have to eradicate Hamas. We cannot live beside them. And so, look, I understand this deal that came in. This wasn't a good deal for Israel, but we signed it because we wanted to bring our family members back.
You're referring to the first phase of the ceasefire. You think it wasn't a good deal
absolutely.
For Israel?
Oh, it was a terrible deal for Israel, but we did it to release our family members back home to the loving arms of their family. The second stage now is being discussed as we talk now. The first step was when Prime Minister Netanyahu arrived in Washington and spoke to Trump and obviously to Witkoff, his envoy. And since then, he's been sent to Qatar to continue these discussions. We are serious about it and we are negotiating it. We have discussed the framework of what is needed as well. And we are hoping that we can reach a diplomatic solution. You know, a war for Israel is not a goal. Mm. On the contrary,
but we
prefer a diplomatic solution.
You releasing all the hostages in one go is something that Donald Trump proposed. In fact, you praised him this idea.
Yes,
from
absolutely.
Him in an interview with the BBC last week.
Well, look, I would put a big question mark on any proposal coming from a terrorist organization in understanding what it actually means. But definitely, if that holds to our standard, you know, and this is something that obviously Israel will want, we want to bring back our family members as quickly and as safely as possible.
Indeed, we're seeing emaciated men being released. We're about to encounter the first body bags to be returned with small children inside. Public pressure is mounting for the hostages to be returned. How do you explain to those families that you're not going to embrace this deal?
Look, from the first stage, we knew and we understood that some of the people, the humanitarian cases, that will be released during the first step, you know, might return, you know, dead. Hamas murdered them in captivity. They starved them. They torture them physically, psychologically, sexually. And we know who we're dealing with.
And so don't you want those people back immediately?
We hope. Of course, that's what we've been doing for a year and a half. We've been fighting to bring them back as quickly and as safely as possible. Matter of fact, I don't know if you've actually reported that, but, you know, in August, they were already, this proposition was on the table. As a matter of fact, there were three propositions: the Qatari proposition, the Egyptian proposition, and the Russian proposition, which Israel said yes to all the three of them. Hamas didn't just say no. They refused to send a negotiation team to Qatar to even discuss it. So there wasn't even anyone to talk to. We were really talking to the negotiating countries and not to Hamas. So this is not about Israel, but this is about dealing with a terrorist organization.
Mm. Just to move to what Israel could do, are you going to withdraw your troops fully from Gaza? That's what phase two of the ceasefire deal stipulates.
Look, you know, I don't know what you mean about what's going to happen in stage two. These things are being negotiated as we speak now. We have been demanding the return of all of our hostages since day one, since the 8th of October. Matter of fact, for almost 3 weeks, not even a single Israeli soldier stepped foot in Gaza, putting on the table the suggestion
Sharon
to return
Haskell,
the hostages immediately now.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there.
Hamas declined.
Sharon Haskell, thank you. Sharon Haskell is Israel's deputy foreign minister. Syria now. 2 months have passed since the fall of the Assad regime. You'll probably remember those images of families across the country immediately beginning the search for their missing relatives, people who disappeared in the decades that Bashar al-Assad and his father ruled the country. Human rights organizations estimated over 100,000 Syrians have disappeared since the uprising began in 2011. Well, out of that number, it's estimated that over 3,000 children are among the missing. The BBC found evidence that some children who were detained with their families were transferred to orphanages. Many of those children have been reunited with extended members of their families. But for others, the search is still ongoing. Our correspondent Lina Sinja sent this report from Damascus.
At Merjes Square in central Damascus, men and women gathered from across Syria. Each hold a photograph of one of the thousands of Syrians whose fate is still unknown after the fall of Bashar al-Assad.
This is my cousin, actually. We lost him when he was 16 years old. They came and they arrested him. His father shot. He was not doing anything.
Human rights organizations say hundreds of the missing are children. Atiyah al-Musa and his wife Ghaziyeh are searching for traces of their missing granddaughters, 4-year-old Cham and 5-year-old Islam. They, along with their mother Hiba, were taken in 2014 by the security forces who raided their house in a suburb of Damascus.
We search in security branches. We were told they are in state security. Somebody told me that some girls were sent from detention centers to Lahn al-Hayat orphanage, but they denied having them.
After the fall of the regime, the search started. Reports came out that some children who went missing could be found at orphanages. Like many families, Atiyah and his wife desperately hope they will find their loved ones.
No one is helping us, neither the Ministry of Social Affairs nor the orphanages. We lost our daughter. Are we going to lose her daughters too?
The Ministry of Social Affairs say they are investigating the cases of missing children. I met Mr. Ahmed Anizi, who is in charge of searching the dusty, messy, and untouched files found in the basement of the ministry.
We are not getting results yet, because those in charge of these orphanages are complicit with the previous regime.
Mass graves are regularly being discovered. In 1 week, 4 were discovered in this neighborhood in Damascus. The White Helmet Civil Defense say there were remains of children among the bodies.
In many places like this one, the bodies are burned to cover the evidence. Parents who are hoping to find their missing children, for them, the greatest fear is that they might be in the bones found here.
The basement's owner, Ahmed Laham Sayed, says for years he knew there were bodies below and couldn't talk. He told me he had nightmares hearing the cries of women and children.
This is Lahn al-Hayat orphanage, where Mr. Musa and his wife Ghaziya came to find traces of their granddaughters. We've been told that this is a place that received many children by order of security forces of the Assad regime without any proper documentation. Mr. Mu'tasim Salumi is the new director. I asked him whether he knows anything about the case of Shaman Islam.
No, I don't. But I learned that many families used to come here looking for their children. We welcome any family here. We want to help.
For Atiyah and Ghaziyeh,
this might not be comforting. But for some of the children here, there is now a better chance of being found.
The BBC's Lina Sinjab in Damascus. This is NewsHour coming to you live from London. Well, we started this edition of the programme with a focus on Ukraine, a nation that once enjoyed American backing, but is now questioning if it can really count on the US under the new Trump administration. But cross to a different part of the globe and you'll find a country that is experiencing a completely different relationship with Donald Trump and his inner circle, a country that's also in need of US security protection, the Philippines. It's enduring near weekly naval and aerial confrontations with China as the Philippines battles to carve out what it considers to be its territory in the contested South China Sea. I met with the country's foreign minister, Enrique Manalo, during his visit to London this week, and I asked about his relationship with the new U.S. Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, and the meetings they've shared so far.
Well, so far, I have to describe them as being very productive and really opening the door to even more cooperation over and above the activities we had with the previous administration. In other words, my discussions with Secretary Rubio, I'd have to classify as very important and, of course, very positive.
Let's focus in on the cuts to U.S. aid. USAID gave $180 million to the Philippines last year for HIV programs, for disaster relief, among other things. Did you ask Marco Rubio to stop the cuts or did you explain the impact of them to him?
First, let me say that the Philippines has benefited from USAID. And of course, it would have been preferable that no changes were made, but we have to respect the decision of the United States. It's their program. But that being said, when I met Secretary Rubio last week in Munich, it was he who actually raised the possibility of exemptions or exceptions to potential or possible cuts. So I took that as a positive sign.
Did he elaborate at all on what those exemptions or exceptions might be?
He didn't go into the details, but he said there's a possibility and they're looking into that possibility. I mean, for the Philippines. I don't know for other countries.
You have a mutual defense treaty in place with the U.S. You have overlapping claims with China in the South China Sea or the West Philippine Sea, as I know you might like to refer to it as. When does this treaty come into effect in regards to the increasingly violent confrontations that we're seeing involving Philippine sailors, Philippine fishermen?
Well, the treaty itself is fairly clear on the type of situations where the MDT would take effect. And the United States and the Philippines have reaffirmed that.
What is the red line for the Philippines when it comes to altercations with China? When will you step up your own military action?
Well, first of all, we have no plans of military action. What we're really trying to do is to prevent any of these incidents from escalating to situations where you may have to be faced with the question you asked me. And we have pursued and agreed, even with China, that we need to manage these incidents in a proper way to avoid them escalating. And certainly we have to make clear that we will continue to assert our rights and our sovereignty in this area.
John Byers, who is the newly appointed Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Southeast Asia. He's openly talked about the possibility of the U.S. striking a direct bargain with Beijing, in which China agrees to decrease its patrols of the South China Sea if the U.S. removes military troops or equipment from the Philippines. How would you respond to such a deal?
Well, I'm not aware yet of any deal or any talks to that effect. What I am very clear on, though, is my discussions with Secretary Rubio, discussions between our defense secretary with the Secretary of Defense of the United States and the National Security Advisor, and the talks between President Trump and President Marcos when they had a phone conversation. And the conversations and the talks were basically the same. In other words, again, a reaffirmation of the commitment of the United States. So we will have to use that as the basis of how we cooperate with the United States.
The Philippine Foreign Minister Enrique Manalo in conversation with me in London this week. Now,
The third series of the award-winning American black comedy White Lotus began at the weekend with, as fans would expect, a new luxury resort setting and a largely new cast. The show follows the lives of a highly dysfunctional group of staff and guests at an upmarket resort chain. What many viewers didn't expect or welcome was the largely revamped theme music. My colleague James Kumarasamy has been discussing the rights and wrongs of changing theme tunes with the composer, writer and broadcaster Neil Brand. First, how important is the theme tune to a TV series?
It's part of people's, not just their recognition factor of these programs, but it's almost part of their kind of security. One of the big things about a TV theme, it's got to tell people who are out in the kitchen, this program's starting, you like it. And then on top of that, it's got to sound pretty similar every time that episode comes back in the series, or each time the series comes back. So that always there's a branding to it, but it's one where people kind of go, ah, great, you're home, come on, you know you like this, sit you down, everything's going to be like it was 25 years ago.
So the theme tune that's caused all the fuss over the last couple of days, the White Lotus theme tune. So yeah. The first two series, it's a similar theme, but they've slightly changed it because the key to the show is each season is in a set in a different country. This time they have gone a bit further than a lot of fans like.
They have, and that's been a problem. I could see how it works, because the first season, the theme tune got a real ethnicity to it, but really interesting vocalising as well. Second theme, they were in Italy, and suddenly you had an operatic feel to it, but still keeping those kind of claps and those vocalizations. This third one now that has come, obviously it's changing with the mise-en-scene of each of the series. The theme is sort of there, but it's gone much, much darker, and I think people have been put off by the fact that suddenly it's beginning to sound like a dance piece. This is starting to sound a little bit generic.
And can fiddling around with a theme like this actually be terminal for a franchise?
I wouldn't have thought so. The plain fact of the matter is that no one is going to mess around with a theme that works. And if it's working, you'll probably find it'll be back in so many different ways. I mean, you take something like The Wire. All the angels sing about you. It's basically the same number, which has been there the whole time, Down in the Hole by Tom Waits. But season one was the Blind Boys of Alabama singing it. Next one was Tom Waits. Next one was the Neville Brothers. So it was changed each time, but it was the same number. And this is what tends to happen with very, very long-run TV series. Is no one is going to destroy a theme that is working really, really well and replace it with something nobody knows. That would be absolute disaster.
Composer Neil Brand speaking to James Kumarasamy. I'm Celia Hatton. Thanks for joining us on NewsHour.